Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Preacher's Forum podcast. I am your host, Dr. Clint Haycock. I'm coming to you once again from The Rock here in stunningly beautiful North Wales, where we live in the United Kingdom. Today's episode represents a continuation of my series that I've been doing for a few months now. I've called it British Accents. And what this series does is it represents the opportunity that I have as a transplanted American. I've lived in Britain for nearly 12 years now. It's my chance to talk to British people from all walks of faith, all walks of life. And what I want to do is I'm interested to get their take, or their point of view on God, theology, religion, experiences of church, spirituality. I mean, you name it, I'll talk to anybody. And really, this is consistent with the vision of the Preacher's Forum podcast and the website www.preachersforum.com. It's all about engaging in critical thinking about God, the church, and spirituality. Now, this particular episode of my British Accents series of podcasts, it's got to be one of my all-time favorites so far. I recently traveled down to Birmingham, England, to interview a guy that I met. It was about 3 years ago at a church conference. And this show is the first half of a conversation that I had with Dr. Ash Barker, who, along with his wife Angie, they originally hail from Australia. But this is what makes the British Accent series so great. It's, in my opinion anyway, like most of our increasingly globalized world, Western societies are becoming more increasingly diverse, aren't they? And so here we have Ash Barker, born and raised in Australia, but whose mother was Scottish. Now, I don't want to get too much into it at this point because I want to let him tell you his story and more of their story as a family. But I'll just say at this point that prior to moving to Birmingham, it's about 3 years ago, he and his family lived in a slum of Bangkok, Thailand. It was called Klong Toi. They lived there for about 12 years. They were missionaries there. Now, in this episode, Ash is going to tell a little bit more about their story. He's going to talk about some of the amazing things that came out of their experiences when they lived in the slums of Bangkok those 12 years. And as we get into the show, their entire approach to mission, as you'll hear about, was what he calls being incarnational. Now, what does that mean? Now, we're going to discuss that topic quite a bit in this first half, but simply put, it's the idea that Jesus himself modeled during his lifetime on earth. In the words of Eugene Peterson's translation of the Bible, which is called The Message, John 1:14 says, Jesus took on flesh and moved into the neighborhood. And really, that's the essence of what it means to be incarnational. In other words, if you're trying to reach people, you can't just preach at people a message of the so-called good news, but you can't at the same time not be willing to share life on a daily basis with the people that you're preaching at. Now, Dr. Ash Barker, he's written at least 3 books on the subject of mission and incarnational mission, and some of these have obviously come out of their experiences when they were living in the slums of Thailand. In 2009, he wrote the book Make Poverty Personal, Taking the Poor as Seriously as the Bible Does. And then a few years later, he came out with his next book called Risky Compassion. And what it is, it's a reflective piece where he looks back on some of the insights that he gained from those 12 years living in that slum in Bangkok. And then he attempts to weave some biblical insights into his philosophy of mission and ministry. And then a few years ago, 2014, he wrote his third book, Slum Life Rising, How to Enflesh Hope Within a New Urban World. And you can find these on Amazon. As with his other books, Ash takes on the issues of poverty, slum life, living incarnationally, right in the midst of some of the most poor and the disenfranchised of society. And you know, really, this is what I like about Ash and his wife Angie. As one reviewer of one of his books said on Amazon, Barker lives what he preaches. Living consistently with the message that you're trying to proclaim, that's how you earn credibility with the people that you're trying to reach and the people you're trying to help. I mean, it's far more than just trying to get people to come to church or to agree intellectually with some sanitized or bullet point version of the gospel message. And we talk about this a bit in this episode. It's also far and away, I think, much more consistent with how Jesus himself lived and how the life that he modeled. You know, he lived in solidarity with his followers. Jesus was willing to point out the hypocrisy and the oppression within society. And a lot of times, it was the very religious elite who were doing the oppression and living lives of hypocrisy. But these were supposed to be the ones who were in charge of setting people free and helping them get to God. You know, we saw that in the Gospels, Jesus shares the ups and downs of everyday life with his friends, with his followers. He lived in community. He lived in true fellowship. And all the while, he was basically homeless. He was in a condition of poverty. And yet, he really did a couple of simple things. He served God. He served others by simply going around doing good for anybody. It didn't matter. It was regardless of their social status, from all the way at the bottom, the prostitutes, the lepers, the cripples, all the way up to the very richest members of society. So you take a Christian leader like Ash Barker, who actually lives out what he preaches, and today I can assure you that is an exceedingly rare commodity indeed. And what you're going to hear in this first half of our conversation, you'll hear the passion. It comes through when Ash starts talking about the many things that they were able to do to help bring about change in their communities. Didn't matter where they lived, whether they were in the slums of Bangkok or now where they live in this incredibly ethnically diverse but very poor area of Birmingham called Winston Green, and that's where they're currently located. It's kind of funny because it's kind of all come full circle in sort of an organic way. And as you'll hear, Ash and Ange, they're really motivated by this concept of incarnational living in the neighborhood. He and his wife, what they do is they run what they call the New Begin House and the New Begin School for Urban Leadership there in Winston Green in Birmingham. Now, if you know the history of it all, the famous theologian Leslie New Begin, of course, after whom their school is named, now he actually ministered in that Winston Green area of Birmingham in the 1980s. After he'd served as a missionary in India for 30 years. And it was during his time there in the Winston Green area as a minister that Leslie New Begin developed a lot of his concepts of urban mission and missional theology. And through his writings and through his influence, he's come to be seen really as one of the most influential voices on the topic of the theology of mission in the late 20th century. So that's why I say it's kind of come full circle. So for Ash and Ange, with the work they're pioneering in the same area where New Begin himself served as he returned from mission, they're in a sense kind of completing that circle, and they're trying to raise up urban leaders. All right, that's enough of an introduction to this episode. Now I'm going to give you the pleasure of listening in to the conversation that Ash and I had. So without further ado, I give you Dr. Ash Barker, Incarnational Living in the Neighborhood, Part 1. Okay, everybody, I am here with Dr. Ash Barker in lovely downtown Birmingham. This is Ash. You want to say hello to everybody?
Hello, everybody.
Now, this is a series, we call it British Accents. Now, this is really interesting because, as you'll discover, Ash is, well, would you consider yourself British?
Well, my dad is English, my mum is Scottish. I was born in Australia.
But... Oh, man. Okay, so you were born in Australia. Your mom was, she was from whereabouts in?
In Tayport, just near Dundee in Scotland.
But this is really interesting thing because
Do you consider yourself Australian then? Would you say?
Well, I lived 12 years in Bangkok as well, so I'm very mixed up.
You're very mixed up. How long have you been back in, or I said back in England, but this is really the first time you've lived here since you were in Thailand.
That's right. So actually, I've never lived in the UK before
here. Right.
I was born in Australia. Mum and Dad met in Australia. So we've been here, coming up to 3 years.
Right. And do you like Birmingham?
I love Birmingham.
You love Birmingham?
Yeah.
Ash lives in an amazing, it looks like a much older house, doesn't it? But it's built in the 1930s.
That's right.
Which, if you're Australian or American, that's incredibly old. But in this country, 1930s is nothing, is it?
You know? I mean, there's a church around the corner that was built in the 1900s.
So. Right. Yeah.
So the 900s, I should
say. Oh, the 900s.
Yeah.
Even the 1900s would be old in America, wouldn't it? Yeah. So I'm really interested to talk to Ash today because we met about probably 3 years ago, I think it was, at a church conference.
Yep.
And I heard Ash speaking about, and you must have just moved to the UK.
Yeah.
Not long before that.
Yeah.
So can you tell us your story? I mean, this is an amazing story of when you lived in Thailand with your family. I mean, this is just an unbelievable story of mission. And I love what I want to talk about is your kind of model of mission.
Sure.
All right. So where did you and your family live in Thailand?
Yeah. So we moved in 2002.
Right.
To Klong Toei. So Klong Toei is Bangkok's largest slum. It has about 100,000 people in one square kilometer.
Wow.
And we lived right in the middle of that. Our daughter was five. So I'm married to Ange. It was five when we first arrived. We sold everything we had and we began to immerse ourselves in the life of that neighborhood. We were there for 12 years.
So you lived in a slum in part of Thailand, Bangkok, for the better part of 12 years.
Yes.
I mean, what was your model of mission? Because, okay, I've been to Nairobi. I've been to some other places on these mission trips, as they would call it. What we saw, in certainly in Africa, was the white Western missionaries lived in a compound, I mean, 30 or 40 miles outside the city of Nairobi, for example, in a nice gated, guarded compound. You guys lived in a slum for 12 years. I mean, what made you decide that that was the model you needed to embrace?
Yeah, and so there was a few things. One is an incarnational approach. What does it mean to follow the God who doesn't just live in heaven and visit us on the weekends, but actually became one of us and joined in and shared his life with us as well as his death and resurrection? So this idea of the incarnation of Jesus became very important. But as we explore that further, actually, there are some limitations about what does it mean to be incarnational. And that was very much our approach. Initially, it was very much that's the model. Jesus, love Eugene Peterson's version of the message. Yeah, the word became flesh and blood and moved into the neighborhood. And so that's kind of what we were thinking when we first moved in. But very quickly, we came to the limits of that as a metaphor because in the end, I was coming from Melbourne and Melbourne wasn't heaven. we're not the messiahs. And it was so much that what's different about our life in Klong Toei to Jesus and vice versa. So where we got to as an incarnational model is that we have an incarnating God. We have a God who's making real his promises.
Right.
And to incarnate means to enflesh or to make real. So what we can do is enflesh hope. What we can do is join, participate, and follow the incarnating God into a place like Klong Toei and see hope emerge.
Yeah.
And so we really, rather than being the solutions, we really saw ourselves as signs of hope. Leslie Newbegin, actually, we're in Leslie's old patch here.
Yeah.
He said the role of the church is to be a sign, foretaste, and instruments of God's coming kingdom in a place.
Right.
And that approach is very much what we're about. So, yeah, it's very hard to do that in practical if you're 50 miles away living in a gated community.
Yeah.
When you want to be a sign, foretaste, and instrument of God's coming kingdom in the place, you've got to do it up close and personal. You've got it in a slum. It's a crazy place to live.
Yeah.
And if you don't know what's going on, you can make incredible mistakes. You can be taken for a ride.
Oh, yes.
So to work with what God is already doing at Place.com Toys, it was a real challenge, but we could work from the ground up and see amazing things happen. One of my favorite stories is one of our neighbors, her name was Pooh.
Yes.
P-double-O. And she was a terrific cook. And she just lived a few doors down from us, and she'd sell food out of her house, essentially, for the whole neighborhood. Very few people had kitchens. Our house was about the size of four double beds when we first lived there. And that was 8 years out of our house.
And you had a whole family in there.
Yeah, so our son was born about a year after we arrived. Our daughter was five when we first arrived. And so it was much easier for 50p to buy a big plate of rice from Pooh than it was to try and cook ourselves. And she was a great cook.
Well, it was good, too.
That's really good.
Yeah.
And she did the dishes as well. So
even better.
It was a good deal.
Win-win.
But then one day the price of rice went through the roof, and she couldn't afford to sell her food at the same price. So other people in the neighborhood just couldn't afford to buy her food. And she was getting further and further into debt.
Mm.
And she went to Ange one day, and it was like the five-year mark of us being there, and said, look, I'm not sure what we're going to do. We're getting bigger debt. Do you have any friends who can give you a job somewhere?
Right.
And Ange said to her, look, you're such a great cook. Why don't you teach people how to cook? Why don't we start a cooking school?
Right.
And Pooh didn't have a lot of confidence in those days, but Ange, you know, kept at it with her.
Yeah.
And eventually we had some friends from Australia visit, and she took them to the local market. Right. The market's crazy. I mean, there's crickets for sale to cockroaches,
you name it.
Frogs with the stomach, the heart still beating, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So people found that crazy, and then she came back, and she was just a natural. And within 6 months, her cooking school became the number one thing to do on TripAdvisor in Bangkok.
Yeah.
Number two was the Grand Palace. And then we did a cookbook. Of course, the cookbook was called Cooking with Pooh.
Yes.
And,
I love that story. Cooking with Pooh. That's one of the greatest titles ever.
It won the oldest book title of the year at the Frankfurt Book Fair, the biggest book fair in the world.
Yeah.
And then comedians all around the world.
Oh,
Jonathan Ross in this country, Stephen Fry. And Jamie Oliver. Jamie Oliver did an episode with Pooh. He's got this apron on that said, I cook with Pooh, and I liked it. and so she sold 50,000 copies of the book now. And for me, I mean, a lot of ministry models look at the problems with like Tom Toy and say, there's nothing good here. How do we meet all the needs here?
Yeah, and you can just no end to the needs. That. Yeah, but literally.
If you look at the skills and the talents and what God's passions that people have and work with that, when you could with Pooh story, you couldn't. Okay, we're going to find someone with a funny name and build a cooking school at it. You couldn't
make this stuff up, literally.
You couldn't. But if you work with people's what they have, there's an old Chinese proverb actually. It says, go to the people, live with them, learn from them, love them. Start with what they know, build with what they have. But with the best leaders, when the work is done, the task accomplished, the people will say, we've done it ourselves.
Ah.
And that's been our approach. And it's amazing when you open it up like that. It's amazing. So over the years in Tom Toy, by the time we left, there was a community center that was about to fall down and is now thriving.
Yeah.
We had preschools, had football. We had lots of social enterprises, a handicraft business that was doing $250,000 turnover a year. Employed lots of women who would have been in prostitution or in jails otherwise. So, and of course, small house churches that people could run themselves.
Yeah.
That was an important part of what we did. But we didn't go there in that kind of old missionary, we've come to fix everybody up.
Yeah, yeah.
It was very much we've come to join and participate and follow the risen Christ. And as we do that, the promises of God for human flourishing, the shalom, the people God in place are in harmony together, those promises can come true. And, and that's what I work towards.
So less of a top-down than a grassroots, from within the people type of thing, essentially is what Jesus himself did, ironically enough.
That's right.
Now, here's a question that comes to my mind when I'm hearing you describing your sort of model of mission.
Yep.
How do you relate that to an urban setting in the West, whether it's in North America, Britain, wherever, you know, let's say you've got a pastor of a typical sort of church in an urban setting, you know, sitting there going, hey, Ash, that's a great story, but it's about Thailand. It's living in the slum. How does that relate to my I want to be missional. I want to be incarnational, but I don't know what to do. How do I get involved in this model?
It's a good question. I'm not sure the answer to so many. But we did when we came to Winston Green. So Winston Green is inner city Birmingham.
Yeah.
It was literally released in Munich. And if you read any of his books, like Foolishness of the Greeks, Gospel and Flawed Society, he wrote those books while he was here in this day.
Right.
And the challenges of high Muslim, Hindu, Sikh communities. We're one of the very few white people in this neighborhood.
Yeah.
And so it is a challenging neighborhood. But the principles still apply. What is it that people have in terms of their gifts and assets and strengths? And if we can work with those things, it's amazing what could happen. So one of the places we started was a local primary school. There was a new principal there. And Ange got a job there at the local primary school. It was a failing school.
Right.
The government was going to close it down. And Oasis, which is a Christian charity and education organization, came in to try and renew it. And the beauty of schools is that, you know, it is a kind of a positive place in the community. People really want it to work.
Yeah.
Everybody wants it.
They have an investment in there for sure.
Yeah, the children are going there.
Yeah.
And so we worked initially with families from the school and what skills and gifts do they have. Now, some things stay the same. So a cooking school got started very quickly because there were lots of women who were brilliant cooks. They could cook Jamaican food. They could cook Romanian food. They could cook Polish food. All kinds of African countries. Lots of refugees are coming from Syria and other places like that. And all of them have traditional food. All of them can teach other people how to do it. So they've got a great story to tell. And so Ange organized them into a cooking school. So this idea, the people with the problems are the best ones to deal with them. And when those people work together, the best chance of change happens. And so Andrew helped organize them into what was called the Flavors of Winston Green. One of the bizarre things, just to get to know the neighborhood we did, is we recognized a lot of young people were coming out of refugee and trauma kind of backgrounds from Syria. One boy was from the Congo. He'd been a child soldier 6 months ago, and suddenly he's doing grade six at primary school.
Yeah.
And you probably know here in the UK, the infrastructure for mental health and counseling, and even medical care, it's all been stripped away. And so any help that would have happened 10 years ago is simply not available anymore.
Hmm.
And so one thing my son actually came up with is, you know, kids love animals. And we had some experiences in Australia of alpacas being really helpful for teenage boys, particularly who are kind of struggling to express themselves.
Yeah.
But with animals, finding a great kind of comfort and productivity and helping out and building confidence. And so we started a mobile petting zoo. For animal encounters. And actually, if you want to get to know your neighborhoods, walk an alpaca from your house to a primary school and watch people come out and want to get selfies, you know, with the alpaca. And so Cookies and Cream became kind of celebrities in the neighborhood.
Oh, nice.
I think that's kind of been our approach. One of my favorite books actually is the New Parish book.
Hmm.
What they talk about is can we take neighborhood seriously? Can we take parish?
Yeah.
But can we imagine it in different ways? And what they talk about is can a neighborhood is a place you can live a lot of life in that's big enough to live a lot of life.
Oh, yeah.
But small enough to be a known character and the unfolding drama of that place.
Mm.
And I like that. And so, yeah, we're kind of characters. We've taken over the old vicarage that wasn't being used.
Yeah.
And opened it up. So we have community meals, got to know names that way. We've got youth groups now that have started. We've got all these kind of social enterprises. We've got animals kind of coming and going all the time.
Yeah.
And so alpacas and sheep and
we brought our
lizards.
And we just added one more.
Yeah, yeah, excellent. They fit right in.
Yeah.
And so people feel really comfortable coming here. And part of the space in a place like Winston Green is that people can feel quite isolated and alone.
Yeah.
And so just having some space so a community meal where there's no preaching, there's no Bible studies, just come and meet some people in the neighborhood.
Just building relationships.
Building relationships and bringing people together. And it's amazing how we're in the office of Newbegin House at the moment. It's amazing how people sneak off together and let's talk about how we can start a football club. So that was one of the things the guys started talking about. There's actually no organized football in this area anymore.
Oh, right.
West Bromwich Albion is a local football team. I just happened to meet the head of the football academy here. So he's in charge of recruitment and getting young players into the club. And he used to live at Winston Green and escaped as a, you know,
He
got out, but had a real burden for this community. Didn't identify himself as a Christian or anything, but Steve Hopcroft is one of the top scouts in the country, actually. So he said, look, I'd love to see if we get a football club going. So we worked with all the kind of guys here. We worked with West Brom, and we had 700 young people come to trials, and we've just started a new football club called Soho Albion FC.
Right.
And we've got some amazing coaches. We've got brilliant, about 70 players who are training now, ready for the season. Now, none of these things, we came prepared. You know, it wasn't a pre-prepared plan. Yeah.
You didn't have an agenda.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't that at all. It was all very much what assets and passions and strengths do people have, and how can we bring it together? And actually, we've got some really good young players.
Yeah.
And the families love it. Most of these kids would be sitting on Saturday morning watching TV or playing games. Here they are out in the park, and the parents have come out too, and they're getting some of the best coaching in the country, and there's a pathway for them to play Premier League football if they have the talent, if they have the desire.
You know what?
And actually some of these young guys will make it into the West Brom's academy. They'll be picked for that. And Steve's really working hard for them. So, again, some of these things, it's not rocket science, but we do need to create space, and we've got to be prepared not to be in control. And that's the trick. Because churches, so often we want it sanitized, we want it be in control, we want it in the power over what's going on. And actually, when we help initiate a football club, I'm the co-director with Steve, and another guy, another Ashley as well, we're kind of the core of it, but actually it doesn't belong to our church, it doesn't belong to our organization, which will help it to have its own entity.
Right. It's not a Christian football team.
It's not a Christian football team. It's a neighborhood, and some of us are Christians and part of it.
Right.
And that's, I think, really critical, that we're not trying to pull people out of their environment and send them off somewhere else. I mean, that's the tragic model of places like Nairobi and other places where you see missionaries living in compounds. People think, oh, to be a Christian means to live in a compound. Where we've really made it, we'll become Western and have the white picket fence and we'll be able to behave like that. Here in the West, you often find that actually the default culture of church is actually middle class.
Yes, it's true.
And so when it comes to working class people, people from refugee migrant, Hindu, Buddhist, Muslim backgrounds, we don't want them to have to become white middle class to encounter and follow Jesus. We want them to do that in a natural environment as possible, and that they express themselves, that their discipleship with the people around them. And so, unless we're prepared to do that, why should they be prepared to do
that? Why should they, We want you to change, but we don't have to change.
That's right.
Because I was thinking when you were talking about that so much of evangelism, quote unquote evangelism, gets defined narrowly back to that, you know, sort of typical church setting. Evangelism, what is it? It's an attractional model. Just bring them in the doors of the church. The professional minister will seal the deal. Preach the gospel, whatever that means, and it becomes like an intellectual exercise. You've got to believe certain things, and then you're at some point. I'm not sure what that point is. You say the sinner's prayer? I don't know. You go, okay, this person, we're pretty sure he or she, it really is a Christian. You can come into our church now and you're one of us, you know. But, I mean, all the things you're describing, setting up football clubs and, you know, cooking schools and all these ethnic populations coming together, you know, what does that have to do with the gospel? But you could say, well, that's the gospel. Everything you're describing.
Well, the gospel is good news.
Why does it have to be this intellectual ascent to the Romans Road or the four spiritual laws? Or what does that have to do with a football team in a neighborhood?
Well, the gospel is good news of the kingdom of God. That's what the gospel is. And whenever it becomes intellectualized in a very narrow set of truths, I think we undermine the nature and the dynamic nature of the gospel of Jesus Christ, because Jesus is present in this neighborhood. We want people to encounter and follow that Jesus, and that's what transforms people's lives. And the vision isn't, come and get them out of this neighborhood, but the vision is, can heaven come to this neighborhood?
Yeah.
Can God's will be done here in Winston Green as it is in heaven. That's what we're wanting. That's the good news. And so everyone can do that at their own pace, at their own way. I think, yeah, I mean, this is not original to me, but you know, the idea is we just get them to believe the right things.
Mm-hmm.
That'll fix it.
Yeah.
It doesn't.
And what does it fix? makes us feel better.
Makes us feel better, yeah.
Yes.
They agree with us.
Especially if they're putting money in the plate.
Yeah.
And there's propping up the system.
Yeah, the whole industry. The whole church industry to sustain. But to see real transformation from the ground up, that requires the gospel of the kingdom. And that's demanding on us as it is everybody else.
Yeah.
A matter of saying, well, we've got the gospel of the kingdom sorted out, and you can. You know, you can just follow us. Actually, we need each other in the same. And so that's why we're partners. That's why we work and need each other. We work together. Yeah, so I'd also say that what people in urban settings, one of the huge needs and the hunger is for belonging, the sense of connection with others.
Community, yeah.
Community. And so if you just go for belief and you can't belong until you do believe the right things. You create incredible barriers and people can't connect. But actually, if you have a sense of belonging, that we're in this neighborhood together, that I think is, you know, it's really, really important, that belonging comes first. And then behavior and beliefs can follow that.
Yeah.
It's not original to me, but I think I've noticed coming back to the West how the hunger that people have who are isolated, lonely, you know, can't. The mental health, the addictions,
so many issues. Yeah,
but if you can connect positively and belong with some people, and not have to jump all kinds of hoops, but actually you love people and they love you, that compassion can cover a multitude of sins.
Amazing things.
And amazing things are possible when we. And the problem, of course, is a lot of church folk have, unless you believe the right things and behave the right way, only then can you belong.
Yes.
That. People get that. People in the community get that. You don't really care about me unless I
check the boxes.
And support your industry. Now, there's all kinds of business people around here, and churches can just be seen as another business.
Trying to get your money. Well, yeah, I think it was, is it Grace Davey who talks about the whole thing about believing without belonging, because that's the current paradigm among a lot of Brits, isn't it, today, is that what she says in her book is that a lot of British people will say, I can believe in God. I don't need to belong to a church and I'm fine. You know, whereas what you're saying is exactly the opposite of that, isn't it? Why can't we just have people belong to something and then don't worry and stress about the belief part of it so much?
Yes.
Whereas in the church, we've made it the other way. First, you have to believe and then you're okay to belong. Because I think a lot of people would say, and I got this when I was a pastor, I used to meet with people down at our local Starbucks, that were kind of on the fringes of the church. Now, they wouldn't come to a Sunday service, but they felt comfortable sitting down at the Starbucks with me and having a coffee. And we talked about a lot of different things, not just about God, but a lot of life problems and issues. Yeah. And one of the elders said to me one time, he said, you're wasting your time down at that Starbucks. And we are not paying you to sit at Starbucks. He said, if people want to see you as the pastor, they can come to the office, make an appointment and sit in your office and then they can talk to you. They work, you know. And so that wasn't seen as somehow legitimate ministry, sitting with someone just simply at a Starbucks who would never darken the door of a church. And so I had to stop doing that. And all those connections that I've made in the community just because I said, well, I'm sorry, I can't meet with you at the Starbucks. Well, why? We used to meet once or twice a month. You know, I can't. I'm being told by the elders that I can't do that anymore. Yes. And that whole relationship was just gone. Yes. And you think, okay, that sort of mentality, that compartmentalized thinking
is
a big part of the problem, isn't it?
Coming back to the West, that has been a much bigger deal than it was when I left. Not just for ministry, but for teachers, for nurses, for everyone's compartmentalizing their lives and becoming service providers.
Mm.
And so the minister, the minister provides counseling, preaching, you know, provides his outside of that, he's his own person. And actually, that's not a missionary approach at all. God's called us to share our lives with people. That's what Paul did. That's what Jesus did.
Yeah.
And so there are certain things we, when we're providing services, we want to do them well, but we human beings, we're made in the image of God, and our biggest gift is that we can share life and solidarity with other people and love people.
Yeah. And what's wrong with that?
When you only love people under certain parameters, under certain conditions, it actually, and in a neighborhood like this, there's lots of service providers.
Yeah.
But actually not a lot of love.
Mm.
And what the Christian faith should be hallmarked for is that we love people. They'll know us by our love.
Isn't there something in the Bible about
service provision?
In the back somewhere. Yeah, they'll know us by the service that we provide. And not even very well at that, you know.
All right, everybody, thanks once again for listening in to the first half of my conversation with the great Ash Barker. There's so many things that came out of that conversation I was reflecting on later. It's almost too much to take in, really. What's clear from the conversation, I think, is what I mentioned at the beginning of this show, that Ash and his wife Ange, they're very passionate about what they do. You can hear it coming through when he starts talking about what's going on in the neighborhood, in Winston Green, right where they live, in Birmingham. They absolutely believe it, and they practice what they preach. And what I think is interesting is you don't get a sense of empire building from Ash, you know, like we see with so many of these mega church movements today. In fact, I love what Ash said about mission. He said, it's not rocket science, but you have to create space and then be prepared not to be in control. And really what they've done in Winston Green in Birmingham and what they were doing in Thailand as well is just creating a space whereby people in the neighborhood can feel safe to join in. And if anything, they don't really have any sort of agenda or plan going into these encounters. They're just willing to go along with whatever they feel God's already doing or wants to do in their neighborhood. They just want to be a part of it and help others to join in. And then when great things happen and these amazing connections are made, they don't seek to own it. You know, they don't care. As the old saying has it, great things happen when people don't care who gets the credit. And ultimately then, what you see with Ash and Ange is they're living consistently with the way Jesus himself lived, as I was talking about at the beginning of this episode, and what he modeled as an example for us also. Now, I'll leave you with one last thought before I end this episode. I want to read you the vision of the Newbegin School for Urban Leadership. It's simply this: to cultivate a seedbed for urban change, raising up more resilient, compassionate, and innovative urban leaders able to shape our new urban world from the ground up. And if that sounds interesting to you, you can find out more information on their website, www.newbeginhouse.uk. You can also connect with Ash Barker on Twitter at Dr. Ash Barker. Speaking of connections, before I end this episode, I just want to mention there are a few ways you can connect with me also on social media. I'm always up for dialogue about the show. I'm looking for suggestions for future shows or just to meet up and hear your story. You can follow me on Twitter at Preachers Forum. You can connect with me on Instagram also at Preachers Forum. I'd encourage you to stop by my Facebook page, like it too. Facebook.com/The Preachers Forum. And finally, you can feel free to send me an email as well, preachersforum@gmail.com. And also, just one other thing, if you are a subscriber to my podcast on iTunes or Podbean, please do me a favor and rate and review the show, which of course will help with the rankings and the visibility of the show. And I just want to mention this at the very end. If you take a few minutes, have a look at my website, www.preachersforum.com. I think you'll enjoy a series of articles I've been writing and posting, which are under a section called A Satirical Look at the Church. It all started when our church had to fire poor Pastor Jesus, you know. But hey, we've got a new pastor now, Pastor John. He was doing a great job, but he kind of went off the rails a bit. So I'm not going to tell you too much of the story, but you definitely will want to follow along. For pastors and church leaders especially who are listening out there, of all people, you need to check out this series. And what's going to happen, I think you'll laugh through the tears as you read about the trials, the tribulation, really, that so many church leaders and pastors have to go through. And it's really all about expectations, isn't it? That many churches lay on their long-suffering pastors. I'm going to leave it at that, but pastors and church leaders, you're going to know exactly what I'm talking about. All right, once again, thanks for listening in to the first half of my conversation with Dr. Ash Barker. Make sure and come back next Friday for part two of my interview. We're going to get into even more of an interesting conversation about mission, evangelism, urban theology, God, and so much more. I'm your host, Dr. Clint Haycock, and I'll see you once again right here on the Preacher's Forum podcast.